advice that I'm working with the justice section of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, UNO DC, based here in Vienna, where I serve as a focal point on prison reform, a task which, as you probably can understand, more recently involves in an increasing manner the issue of violent extremism in prisons. You may know that UNODC is an organization that has quite a long history in assisting member states in reforming their prison systems in line with international standards and norms. A major breakthrough in that regard was the year 2015. You may know that the General Assembly has adopted a revised set of international standards related to the treatment of prisoners, the so-called UN Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners, the Nelson Mandela Rules. These were in place already since 1957, but in 2011 the General Assembly said it's needed to look at revising and updating these standards, and after 5 years of quite difficult intergovernmental negotiations, the General Assembly adopted this updated set of rules as the Nelson Mandela rules. And these, if you want, are really our compass, our normative compass for the technical assistance that we provide. These are the minimum conditions that the international community as a whole considered appropriate and needed. We deliver technical assistance programs in a variety of member states worldwide, and we also develop technical guidance material on a variety of aspects related to prison management, be it policy guidance on strategies on how to reduce prison overcrowding, pertinent issues worldwide, be it technical issues such as prison file management, or be it the treatment and management of special categories of prisoners, be it prisoners with special needs, or be it mild extremist prisoners, as we will see later on. Now, as Ramin has already mentioned, dealing with this issue at the UN obviously requires that we approach it from a global perspective, the issue of violent extremism, including its very different manifestations in different regions, in different countries, and including the very different resources that are available to tackle this issue in prisons. On the one hand, we talk about the phenomenon of foreign terrorist fighters who return more and more from countries such as Syria and Iraq, very often ending up in prisons. So this is, of course, an issue of great concern here in Europe, but also in other regions of the world, such as Central Asia. On the other hand, we also deal with member states who are directly affected by violent extremist groups that operate on their territory. So-called Islamic State in various countries in the Middle East, Al-Shabaab in Somalia and Kenya, Boko Haram in Nigeria and neighboring countries, etc. And these different situations, of course, also result in very different numbers of violent extremist prisoners the national prison administrations need to deal with. On the one hand, we have situations where there's relatively few violent extremist prisoners trickling into national prison administrations. In other countries, prison administrations need to deal with many hundreds of violent extremist prisoners that are often imprisoned within a very short amount of time. So we're dealing with a wide diversity of situations that we needed to consider in the guidance material that we developed. Now, I think on a general note, it's safe to say that the mission of prisons, safe, secure custody of offenders, active preparation for their social integration at the same time, has never been an easy one. And the phenomenon of violent extremist prisoners has certainly not rendered it any easier. But if we go to the next slide,
please.
Thank you. So if we turn to the scenario that is currently discussed, which is a topic of this conference, namely the risk of prisons, and I put it deliberately in a bit of a provocative way, the risk of prisons turning into potential schools or incubators, as it's sometimes called, for terrorism. challenge of violent extremism in prisons is not taken seriously. Now, this assumption or this risk is refers on the one hand to the management in itself of an increasing number of individuals that are detained on terrorism-related charges, including returning foreign terrorist fighters. On the other hand, we are also dealing with the management of violent extremist prisoners within the overall prison population. And there is great concern, obviously, that there they can have, at least in principle, access to a large pool of potential recruits. Now, if we start with some overall observations related to the prison environment, at first sight, there seems to be really quite some striking similarities between the psychological impact of imprisonment on the one hand and the factors that are believed to at least be relevant to radicalization on the other. An individual, once imprisoned, may experience a crisis of his or herself. A prisoner may experience rejection by his or her native society or peer group. And all prison practitioners will know that it's not unlikely that prisoners, upon experiencing imprisonment, seek to adopt a new sense of identity or a new belief structure. This does obviously not mean that prisoners by definition are vulnerable to radicalization through violence. I would not go that far. But we certainly need to recall and to remember this special context of prisons, this need for identity and for belonging, which is pertinent in prisons, when we talk about the risk of radicalization to violence in closed settings. A second point I would like to mention is that we talk of radicalization in prisons. It's presented as a new risk, a new phenomenon. On the other hand, an associated risk, namely it's informally referred to as criminal contamination in prisons, has long been recognized. What do I mean with criminal contamination? Namely that high-risk prisoners, be it members of organized crime, members of prison gangs, exercise a negative influence on prisoners who are there for relatively minor crimes. This is a risk that has long been recognized. This is nothing new. And it's certainly relevant also when we talk about violent extremist prisoners. So our point is we should certainly look very much into lessons learned from the management of high-risk prisoners when we talk about the specific issue of violent extremism in prisons. And I saw in the agenda, if I'm not mistaken, that we hear from a representative from Italy of how they are dealing with mafia-related crimes in prison. So I think this is very pertinent and important. A third point I would like to mention is that any approach to deal with violent extremist prisoners obviously does not occur in a vacuum. It will always be very closely related to the overall prison system in which it is implemented, including its overall prison conditions, including the overall capacity of prison management, including prison programming and prison policies. So any intervention related to violent extremism in prisons should always be embedded in reform efforts regarding the prison system as a whole. Now, interestingly enough, what we do not have yet really at this stage, at least not at international level, is a solid empirical evidence base to which radicalization to violence in prisons actually occurs. Case numbers are not yet high enough, comprehensive evaluations have not yet been undertaken. So we do not know yet in concrete terms. We can say there is a risk. Recruitment efforts certainly happen in various prisons. But one prison guard in the United States, for example, Professor Hahn, has undertaken an empirical research looking into the number of individuals that have entered the prison system, have been radicalized in the course of their imprisonment, and have, upon release, committed a terrorist act. the number he discovered, and he only looked at the United States, I need to see that, was actually very low. He published a book afterwards called The Spectacular Few, meaning there was very few who actually had undergone this process, but the acts of whom obviously had a huge impact. But just to know that we need to be careful when we assume that radicalization through violence in prisons is a widespread phenomenon. Now, if we continue, in UNODC, obviously, we continue to receive an increasing number of technical assistance requests to address the issue of violent extremism in prisons. That's why, as was mentioned in the beginning, we took the decision in 2015 to develop a dedicated handbook on this topic. When we did so, we were able to build on a sister publication, if I may say so, which UNODC had published the same year, namely a handbook on the management of high-risk prisons, which obviously, as I mentioned, relevant for violent extremist prisoners also. We convened two expert group meetings with participants from national prison administrations and other relevant agencies from all over the world. To review a draft of the handbook and validate its recommendations. The handbook was launched in January this year. It's also available in other languages, Arabic, French, and Russian, and will also be available in German as of early next year. I brought some hard copies, but it's quite a comprehensive handbook, so I couldn't bring so many, but you see the link from which you can download the handbook. Now, what does the handbook say? Obviously, what it does not provide is a magical solution on how the issue of violent extremism in prisons can be solved. It would be lovely if we could come up with one, but the international context is really too diverse to do that. But what it does, very much like other international and regional guidance material that has been developed on the topic, is to point member states to specific areas of prison management to which they want to pay particular attention when trying to address violent extremism in prisons, and to present options that they may wish to take according to their national context. Now, some of these I would like to briefly present. One issue, for obvious reasons, is the training of prison staff in coordination with other law enforcement agencies. It is clear that all staff working in prisons, in particular uniformed staff, play an essential role in detecting, in monitoring, and in countering radicalization to violence in prisons. I don't get tired to say that staff is the single most important element in every prison system. There's obviously infrastructure, there's obviously legislation, there's obviously resources, but when it comes to it, prison staff will be the most important capacity and resource really of any prison administration. So it goes without saying that issues around prison staff selection, prison staff training, prison staff working conditions, question on whether or not a prison is sufficiently staffed are obviously even more pertinent in prisons holding violent extremist prisoners. In our handbook, as you will see, we place quite a strong emphasis on experience, on professional and on alert staff, with the ability really to establish constructive relations with the prisoners under their custody. It's a concept called dynamic security, really prison staff developing an ability to almost a sort of sixth sense, if I may say so, to smell trouble before it arises and escalates into crisis. This is crucial not only for ensuring stability in the prison, but also for generating high quality security intelligence. Now, we of course also know that it's not realistic for prison staff to become experts in specific ideologies or in specific religions. But what is important is for prison staff to have a background knowledge of the religious and cultural backgrounds of the people in their custody, to be able to differentiate signs of radicalization to violence, and to know about reporting channels in case they observe signs, suspicious developments that may be related to radicalization to violence. An interesting case example, I think it's in Germany, in the state of Hessen, and I know that there's a representative from the state of Hessen, but I have not seen him. Is he here?
He arrives tomorrow, okay.
So there will be a representative, because what they did in Hessen was to establish a group of what they call Strukturbeachter, so structural observers, sometimes based in one prison or being in charge of several prisons, which is a sort of central, a sort of focal point, if you want, for regular prison staff to talk to in case they observe developments that they are not sure whether or not they are related to radicalization to violence. And this Strukturbeachter has an enhanced capacity in taking this on, in collecting information and in reacting to such observations. Another point I would like to mention on the next slide, certainly a very important topic, relates to risk management and the need for proper classification procedures upon admission. Now we all know that it's regular prison practice to classify each prisoner through an individual assessment to determine the risks that he or she may pose and the needs that he or she may have. It should be done for all prisoners. Regular classification systems, prisoners are given a corresponding security category and are finally allocated to a suitable prison regime. And this obviously also applies to violent extremist prisoners. And I think here it's very important to recall that, like all other prisoners, violent extremist prisoners are not a homogeneous group. They are not all the same. They differ very much. They may include high-level, key charismatic leaders. They will include the sort of mid-level category facilitators, and they will include a lot of followers, the lower echelons of any violent extremist group. So in order to differentiate between these very different individuals and the different risks that they pose, the different extent to which they may be animal for change, it's obviously very important to generate as much information about these individuals as possible, about their personal background, about their criminal history, about their personality traits, etc. And that's again where this issue of information exchange comes in. The prison administration needs to be able to receive information from other criminal justice professionals, be it from the courts, be it from the police, and others, to generate a pool of information which is as comprehensive as possible. Now, I will not go into the detail on the question on whether or not there is a need for a specialized assessment for violent extremist prisoners. I think we have presentations on VERATO and other tools that have been developed in that regard later on, but just to mention that there's, at the international level, not yet a clear consensus on whether we can use and adapt regular offender assessment systems to also apply for violent extremist prisoners, or whether there is a need for a really specialized assessment for violent extremist prisoners. What I do want to touch upon briefly is the question of allocation and accommodation strategies, because that's still a big controversy, namely the question on whether violent extremist prisoners should be concentrated in separate units or separate prisons, concentration model, or whether they should rather be dispersed into different prisons, different high security prisons, for example. And there is no straightforward answer to which option is the right one. What will depend on the number of violent extremist prisoners you're dealing with, the capacities in terms of your prison infrastructure and staff, etc. There's advantages and disadvantages attached to both models. In the dispersal model, when you try to separate violent extremist prisoners from each other and put them into different prisons, it will obviously have the advantage that it will be more difficult for a violent extremist prisoner to undertake covert activity, including recruitment efforts, without such activity becoming known to the prison administration if there is sufficient supervision. A second advantage of the dispersal model is that it benefits prisoners who want to quit, prisoners who want to abandon violent extremist beliefs because they're not under the continued supervision of their fellow violent extremist prisoners. They're by themselves, so it may be easier to get out. And the most important advantage of the dispersal model is that it prevents the formation of tight groups that reinforce each other in the violent extremist views. Now, the concentration model, on the other hand, if you put all of them together, obviously has the advantage that it reduces the risk of these violent extremist prisoners influencing the general prison population. The prison administration may also be able to focus extra resources in terms of security onto a selected number of prisons where violent extremist prisoners are held. But it indeed has a disadvantage that if you don't watch out, it may lead to violent extremist prisoners reinforcing each other in their extremist views. It will also mean that you have a very stressful environment for prison staff, because you're likely to be faced by a united front of manipulation, intimidation, and violence-related efforts. But we'll hear more about that, and I'm very much also looking forward to hearing about the Dutch experience, which I think has evolved over a longer time period and now differentiates these models even further. I know I'm running out of time, so I'll be, but please raise your hand. I will be talking briefly about my last topic related to rehabilitation and social reintegration, an issue that we must not forget when we talk about violent extremist prisoners. Most of them at some stage will still get out of prison, and we, for obvious reasons, cannot miss out on efforts to rehabilitate them, to, as we say, disengage them from violence. The first decision to be made here is that we need to be very clear about what we want to achieve through rehabilitation efforts. Many talk about de-radicalization, and de-radicalization really implies moving an individual away from a radical belief structure, really trying to achieve change in belief, or whether we want to focus on disengagement, meaning we don't target so much the overall belief structure of the individual, but what we try to focus our efforts on is to break the link to violence. Think what you want, but what we want to agree on is that you do not use violence in order to achieve these objectives. I think this, at least at the international level, this differentiation is very important, because we need to be also clear that being a radical by itself does not necessarily pose a public threat if it is not linked to the intention and the capacity to use violence to achieve these objectives. So that's why in our hand we'll be very much focused on disengagement. Afterwards, a decision will need to be made on whether you want to focus on lower level followers or high level charismatic leaders of violent extremist groups. If you manage to disengage a high level charismatic leader, the impact of course will be significant because a lot of the followers will follow his or her example, but it's of course much more difficult to achieve than trying to disengage lower level followers to quit their group. In general, talking about rehabilitation, there's agreement that any program intervention needs to respond to the various motivations that may have brought an individual to join a violent extremist group, or which may render them vulnerable to radicalization. And I think here again we need to be clear, these motives may be ideological, for sure. It may be that an individual fully identifies with a certain violent extremist cause or a violent extremist. but it does not need to be always ideological. Other motives can include opportunistic motives, meaning individuals joining for reasons related to status, power, excitement, or even as a means to continue and legitimize their regular criminal behavior. Finally, other motives may also be out of a position of weakness or vulnerability, for example, as a result of bullying or coercion or protection in the context of prisons. So for this reason, we say in UWC, do not disregard automatically the sort of regular rehabilitation programs, vocational training, education, access to work programs, etc. This may be valuable interventions for some, whereas other violent extremist prisoners obviously will be in need of much more in-depth counseling to deliver by a cross-disciplinary team of experts, including religious scholars, social workers, psychologists, civic educators, etc. Now, I will conclude with reality check, if you allow me to say so. What you see on the screen is what we very often face at international level in the countries that we are working in. I'm not saying that you face such situations in your countries, but if we talk about addressing violent extremism in prisons at international level, we need to recall that these are images that we see frequently in the context of our technical assistance work. So situations of gross prison overcrowding, situations of very poor prison conditions, and these are, by the way, from different parts of the world. We are not only talking about Africa, we're also talking about all other continents. And it's probably not far-fetched to say that in such circumstances, if you combine it with exposure to violent extremism, all of the outline management approaches that we talked about already, all efforts to detect radicalization to violence in the overall prison population are extremely difficult to implement. Violent extremist prisoners in such prisons will have much more space to operate freely, to dominate the discourse about prison conditions, and to build on a general sense of injustice and anger amongst the overall prison population. So that's why, if you go to the final slide, it does not come as a surprise that all recommendations issued by all different international and regional organizations, all recommendations emphasize the importance of good prison management in line with international or regional prison standards. For us, it's the Nelson Mandela rules, which should be a core component of any effort to counter radicalization to violence in prisons. If prison staff do not receive proper induction training, if a regular offender assessment is not in place, if prisons are exposed to significant degrees of overcrowding or are affected by poor infrastructure, which does not allow the separation of different categories of prisoners, then I don't want to say there is no point of coming up with specialized interventions for violent extremist prisoners, but at least such interventions need to go hand in hand with efforts to reform the prison system as a whole. So, final sentence, no doubt that violent extremism in prisons requires tailored criminal justice responses in some areas, but I would argue, at least when we talk about the international level, that to a significant degree applying good prison management practices which have been identified in international standards quite a long time ago